Chapter 29. Pinky pleaded with me not to take any part in the ceremony. Perhaps he was wise in that. But there was another wisdom guiding me, an instinct that said I needed to accept what had become of War and Glass, to embrace the fact of our union, and that witnessing the Mariner's funeral would aid that consummation. I needed to know that part of me was dead. "You mean well, friend," I told him, "but I have to see this through. I think it will help, too, if the Mariners see we are all willing to respect their traditions. Whatever happens at first camp, I think some of the refugees will see their future in the sea. They will need friends in the Mariners, and the sooner we show our openness, the better." Then I pressed his shoulder. "If one of us were to be spared this, Scorp, it should be you. You've buried my brother at sea already. No one would blame you for not wanting to repeat the exercise."
"It would be harder if I didn't see another Clavaine behind those eyes of yours."
"Not all the time, I hope," I said gently. "Glass has to have her time in the light as well." Then, emboldening myself, "It's just a body. It served me well enough for a few centuries. But I think this one is better suited to the times. Glass was a warrior, and we still have a war to win."
"I'll say one thing. You smell better than you used to."
"Trust a pig to notice that." I smiled. "Come on, we should be going down to the dock. It would be bad form to keep the Mariners waiting." The dock was one of the embarkation stages where I had seen Mariners fussing with their rafts and rigging. It faced an apron of enclosed water, mostly calm, but with a tall arched outlet giving access to open seas, and where the more distant conchs could be seen rising and dipping like children on seesaws. The sea was dark, the sky star-strewn. By Mariner custom, funerals were always midnight affairs. The boat that would carry us back to first camp was being readied for the crossing, stocked with provisions and trimmed for sail, but we would not be leaving until the following morning. It was a bigger version of the Mariner's rafts, with a base formed from 8 tree-like spars and a mast from a 9th. It looked fragile, but it was the same sort of craft that had brought Barras and probably Rose to Marl, and I promised myself not to have the bad grace to doubt either its seaworthiness or the skill of its masters. The funeral raft lay moored to another platform, at right angles to the boat. Torch-lit Mariners were crowded around it in solemn preparation, some in the water and some clambering gingerly around on their webbed hands and feet. By some sign, the workers attending to the boat stopped conversing, broke off from their duties, and moved around to the funeral raft. I could still see very little of it through the press of glistening bodies, but at my approach the Mariners opened up like a curtain. The raft was about as simple as any floating thing could be. It had no sail or means of steering. It was just going to be released to drift and find its own path. It would not need to do so for long. A catafalque had been raised up on the raft, an openwork box made of interlaced struts of baleen. It was wreathed in green vines, forming a lacy connection between every part of the raft and its contents. 4 lanterns were arranged on struts at the corners of this catafalque. Stretched out on top of it, facing the sky, and also partially wreathed, was my body. It was an exceedingly odd thing to be looking at the dead form that one used to inhabit. For a few long moments, perhaps a minute, I thought that I was going to be able to maintain a cold objectivity, as if I had been called to a mortuary and asked to identify the corpse of a person known to me, but not intimately. The version of Warren Clavaine laid out before me was both familiar and unfamiliar. I had grown used to the toll time had enacted on my body, especially in the last few years of life in Sun Hollow. Glass had undone some of that attrition, though, and I was taken aback at the vigour of the person on the catafalque. It was not youthfulness, for this was still an old man's frame, but I looked so much younger and stronger than my mental image of myself. I had never become fat, but where muscles had begun to wither away, there was tone and definition, even in death. I had been readied for something, an ordeal that never came. Or perhaps this had been the ordeal, the challenge of the sea, the defiance of my brother's vow. I looked peaceful. My eyes were closed, my posture restful. Just a strong old man snoozing on his back. However I had died, by drowning or some deeper intervention, there was no visible injury. My limbs were intact, unbroken, unbruised. A blanket of woven green covered me from shin to sternum, an extension of the wreaths, but I doubted very much that it was concealing any visible trauma. Something inside me slipped. The objectivity crumbled in an instant, and I sagged, the strength going from my legs. Pinky seized me. It was no mere body on the catafalque, no mere empty receptacle. It was me. It was the last tangible thread connecting me to the life I had lived when I considered myself a better man, when I had known the love and security of family, the bonds of a small but decent community to which I had given my last strong years. Lives had touched this life. Good lives and good people. A web of love and friendship, gratitude and trust, service and dignity, responsibility and humility. I saw it, shimmering out from the catafalque. Endless quivering strands of silver light, linking Miguel de Raita to the rest of his tribe, and via finer extensions of that same silver web, the rest of humanity. No life was worthless, not even a life built on lies. He had made something that was better than the materials given him. You were a good man, and you were loved. I was crying, weeping not for myself, but for this dead man who had been mourned. By the twist that had united ourselves within one body, I knew that I was both victim and accessory to that crime, and I could condemn and console myself in the same thought. This was a mistake, Pinky whispered, and next time you'll listen. I found the will to say, no, not a mistake. I needed to be here. I needed to feel it. I never doubted you were you.
I know.
But if I had kept a little doubt back, this would have settled it. He turned his snout to the catafalque. You have to let go now. We both have to let go.
He gave you a thread back to Neville. Now it's been broken.
I never depended on it.
His grip on me intensified.
But we're depending on you. Say goodbye, Warglass. Ivril and Rindy had arrived at the funeral raft, flanked by courtiers. Their garb was more elaborate than before, both of them wearing spined headdresses and with their bodies daubed in glowing inks. They met my gaze, then set about the formal part of the ceremony, intoning words for the dead, solemn recitations which were interspersed with sung passages and slow bellowing moans, some of which were accompanied by those gathered, and some of which were the prerogative only of the king and queen. I stood back, allowing the waves of sound to wash over me, devoid of surface meaning but transparent in their emotional intensity. It was not necessary to know the mariner's tongue to understand words of farewell. They did not know this man, had no inkling of his life, carried no catalogue of his deeds or misdeeds. But he had come to their sea and died by it, and if it was a mark against him that he had not heeded their warnings, the mariners were ready to forgive such transgressions. A silence fell. I gathered some composure and eased myself out of Pinky's supportive embrace. I spoke, in a voice still broken by tears. Please tell Ivril and Rindy that this man would be thankful for these words. I do not know what has been said, but I feel the kindness communicated. It is more than we expected, and more than he deserved. I touched my throat. I know, because a small part of him is still within me, and he would have wanted this to be said. You have honored him. Through her translators, Ivril answered, we would not anger a green man by disrespecting his brother, even a brother that was shunned. I nodded, not wanting to contradict her,
but feeling that she was justifying an act of remembrance that would have been extended to any soul lost at sea, almost as if her charity embarrassed her. However it is meant, it is good.
Then you shall finish it,
Rindy said. They were cutting the ties to the raft, ready to cast it loose. Mariners were gathered in the water with long staves, ready to encourage the raft out through the arched opening. But something remained to be done before it was out of reach. The courtiers brought forward a burning torch, and it was passed first to Rindy and Ivriel, then offered to me. I took it, and was ready to lean out from the dock and ignite the raft. But I hesitated and turned to the one who had been at my side since we left first camp. This is Pinky, I announced, addressing all who were gathered. You know him a little by now. Trust me when I say that you could spend another life with him and not know a tenth of what he has seen and done. He was a friend to my brother in his last days, a true and loyal friend, and when my brother called on him to perform a task that should never be asked of any friend, Pinky was willing. Had he not been, then our history, and yours, would have been very different. He has carried the mark of that day ever since. But when I touched my brother's mind, when Green Man spoke to me, the only message he wished me to communicate to Pinky was one of gratitude and fondness. I wronged my brother, and there are some wrongs that are beyond forgiveness. But if there is one thing that united us, it is our common friend, Pinky. I nodded to my body. He knew this man, perhaps for not as long as either of them might have hoped, but for long enough, and he should be the one who accepts this torch. I passed it to him, nervous about his reaction, and gladdened when he did not immediately thrust it back.
I'm a pig, he said diffidently,
then indicating me.
She's something else. You fishy lot are some other things. Barris, probably Rose. There isn't one of us that doesn't have a story about how we got here and what made us. Same as the one you call Green Man. You want my advice? Fear the old guy's moods a little less. Throw your weight around a little. His bite was never as bad as his bark, and this is your world, just as much as it is his.
He gave a shudder of sudden self-awareness.
Well, all I'm saying is, we're a weird bunch. Pigs, merpeople, hemi-demi can join us. But somehow we're here, and we're not dead. That's got to mean something, hasn't it? We keep not dying. We're hanging in. We're a jumble of different ideas and different ways of living, and we squabble. And some of us smell a little funny. Actually, some of us smell really funny. But the main thing is this. We're not a bunch of identical black cubes with only one idea in the universe. We're messy and broken, and we make stupid mistakes. But we aren't stupid, mindless machines that are too dumb to realize their programming no longer makes any sense. We're people. Fish people. Pig people. People people. Creepy zombie spider people. No offense, Warglass.
I've heard worse.
And yet we stick around. Maybe like a bad stain, but so what? Many stains make a universe, and we aren't done yet.
The torch was still burning, but it was wavering and blackening at the edge of its flame, and I could see the slightly concerned looks of the courtiers that it might gutter out before the big moment. Presumably none of their previous funeral ceremonies had had to contend with an overly loquacious pig, and they had no contingency in place. We soon will be, if you don't light that thing, I murmured.
Always there with an encouraging word.
He leaned in and touched the torch to the base of the catafalque. The raft did not erupt into flames instantly, but began to consume itself unhurriedly, a river of sparks racing along the paths formed by the wreaths. They must have been soaked in the same slow-burning preparation used in the torch and the candles. The mariner extended a hand to Pinky and took the torch, daubing it at other points around the raft's extremities, encouraging the fire to burn symmetrically. Then the torch was passed back to Pinky and from him to me. It was ebbing out, flame turning sooty. The raft burned brighter, latticed in fire. The mariners nudged it on its course, employing their staffs deftly. The flames crept up the side of the catafalque and curdled around the reposed form on top of it. I watched for as long as I could, but when the skin on my face began to crisp and blacken, it was more than I could endure, and I risked the tolerance of our hosts by averting my gaze so that I was viewing proceedings through narrowed eyes and peripheral vision. By then, the raft was nearly at the gate. The flames swooped up, formed a pair of swan's wings, enclosing the body and underlighting the arch as it slipped through. A dozen or more mariners swam after it at a respectful distance, occasionally offering it an encouraging prod, but mostly content that it was following whatever strange currents flowed through Marl. Flames daubed the swelling sea, and sparks challenged the stars. "He didn't do too badly in the end," I said to Pinky in a low voice.
"He acquitted himself."
"And would the old man have agreed with you?"
"I think he would."
"Right answer," I murmured.
I gave my old body one last squinting farewell before the walls of the arch snatched it from view, and then I tossed the spent torch into the waters. I did not know whether that accorded with mariner custom, but I felt that the right to do it was mine. Then I turned from the sea. In the course of the funeral, I felt that some chemical marriage had been completed. The fluids had intermixed, become inseparable. Glass was dead, and so was Warren. I was one. I was Warglass. We returned to first camp. The crossing was easier than I had anticipated, for the winds were blowing well and sea conditions were mostly favourable. I thought of the seconds that it would have taken Scythe to traverse the same stretch of water, seconds that might make a difference in some future calculation. But even if it had been ready for flight, my ship could not have been summoned. It was not until we were much nearer to first camp that I felt the whisperings of its thoughts. More than that, though, I thought of how curious an omission it had been to have lived two long lives and never once been swept across water by wind and sail before. Barras, Pinky, and probably Rose were the first ashore, and they had some delicate groundwork to lay. The mariner delegation followed next, and then I ventured on to land, conscious of the many eyes on me. It was no good asking them to accept what I was without question, so I decided my best course was to keep out of their way and say as little as possible, leaving the refugees to the more difficult business of deciding whether their best hopes lay with me or the sea. Nothing would be settled in a day, but certain steps could already be taken. There was no point carrying on with any of the preparations for the resettlement of first camp, so they were abandoned. This was difficult for those who had put their backs into the early work, feeling that their labours had been for nothing. Barras and Pinky reported that some of the revived pigs were extremely disinclined to stop, but in this matter at least I was perfectly happy to assert my authority. I had seen what my brother's rage could do, and I had no doubt that we would not be permitted to remain on these rocks. After returning to Scythe, I had the robots begin reclaiming the materials I had provided, even if that meant tearing apart tables and chairs. I left just enough amenities to keep the revived cases comfortable for another 5 days, which was all the time I was giving them to decide their fate. The others, still sleeping, would need to be woken and polled as well. But if the 12 came to some kind of agreement among themselves, even if it wasn't quite unanimous, that might guide the others to a speedier decision. I had vowed to offer no opinion of my own. Since I was not going to remain on Ararat, it would have been hypocritical of me to take a stance. And I envied them neither course. Coming with us back into space would be hard on our passengers, and with no guarantee of survival. But who would submit to a kind of drowning and rebirth,
emerging into an alien body, without very reasonable qualms. Even the mariners could offer only a shrugging assurance that the sea would welcome the pigs and reshape them for their new lives on Ararat. It was starting to anger me that they had offered this option without the additional clause that it was likely to succeed. Things had been simpler before. So I was content to have enough distractions to keep me within scythe, fussing it back to life. The ship had done well while I was away. My first fear was that it might not recognize my command authority at all, seeing in me an impostor who only looked and spoke like glass. My second was that it might only recognize the limited subset of commands I had assigned to Warren Clavaine. But the ship welcomed me back with all the unquestioning loyalty of a puppy. It was keen to show me the repair schedules it had completed, the deferred upgrades it had worked on itself now that it had the opportunity. It was nearly ready to fly. In fact, quite a lot of the repair stages still to be done could be conducted while it was already underway. "Good ship," I murmured. I went to the infirmary and submitted myself to a full body examination, including a deep neural trawl. The jugglers had changed no part of me on the outside, but it was harder to know what had gone on beneath my skin. Large areas of my idiosyncratic brain structure had been remodeled to accept the memories and personality traits of Warren Clavaine. There was going to be no easy way to tell which of Glass's memories had been deleted or degraded to make room for the new ones, not until I stumbled on some odd absence within myself. I had expected to come back from the jugglers with less of me than before, so I could not feel too hard done by if this or that had been sacrificed. Memory was indeed holographic, distributed across multiple embedded encoding structures, not at all like some clean digital ledger. But the jugglers took apart and reassembled minds at a holographic level as well. Human science could never chase out a memory completely without leaving fuzzy traces, but juggler methods could. Once the scans and trawls were finished, I returned to the command deck and reviewed the results. I zoomed and scrolled through images of myself, peelings and sections, flowering eruptions of cortical structure. My neural augmentations were still in place. The silvery shimmer of implants and cross-connections, which marked my brain as at least partly the work of conjoiner neuromedicine. Were they indeed intact, or was it only my imperfect memory deceiving me? I checked against earlier trawls in Scythe's database. Although my organic tissue had undergone some changes, areas of brain enlarging and shrinking, like districts of a city, jostling against each other and negotiating new boundaries, the implants were unaltered. Warglass was still like glass, in that respect. Every gift that those augmentations had given me was still mine. What of the rest of me? What of the real question? Was it still within me? I intensified the scan's depth and resolution, peeling back layers of myself until a hard metallic form emerged from a fog of tissue and bone. It was still there, still whole. Good. We'll have need of you soon. Need of you in Charybdis. Something snapped me out of myself, back to the immediate moment. It was Scythe, snagging my attention with the faint, repeating tone of a sensor contact. Chapter 30. I called a meeting. Pinky, Barris, probably Rose, the Mariner delegation. They sat in a loose semicircle near the shore, while I knelt and tried to work out the best way to convey the news I needed to share. The complicated, joyous, troubling fact of it, and how much of a mess it was going to make of our already fractured plans.
"Wolves," Pinky said, searching my face.
"Not wolves," I said. "At least, I have no evidence of any near enough to cause us trouble." "What, then?" probably Rose asked. "I don't want any of us to have false hopes. At this point, I know only as much as the ship can tell me, from a very faint reading. But I couldn't not bring it to your attention. If we decide that it's real, we have no choice but to act on it immediately." Pinky scratched at the stub of his ear.
"This isn't helping.
I'm glad you said it, Barras agreed. I worked my jaw. Then I spoke. Lady Arryk may still be alive. Scythe has picked up a weak, moving signal, consistent with a localization pulse of the kind emitted by my suits. There was silence, as I had anticipated. I could see Pinky straining to be the first to comment on my observation, yet holding himself back by sheer force of will, not wanting to expose himself to ridicule or contempt by showing too much haste to believe.
You told us she was lost in the star, Barras said.
She was, I affirmed, in the photosphere of bright sun, when we were completing our slowdown. But here's the thing. We were moving very quickly when it happened, faster than the star's escape velocity. Lady Arryk would still have had that velocity when she fell away from us. If she had the luck to make it out of the photosphere, out of the stellar envelope and into clear space, she'd have kept moving, far faster than Scythe. She'd have passed Ararat long before we did. And I nodded out to the horizon, to a patch of pearl-coloured sky above it. The trajectory fits within a margin of error. The signal is moving at the right speed and in the right direction.
If it all fits, yes, probably Rose said. If it all fits, why did we not go looking for her already?
Because by all that's sane, she shouldn't be alive. I knew the capabilities of my suits. It was dangerous enough for Lady Arryk to go out on the hull when she did, but at least she had the armoring skein to protect her, and some benefit from the cryo-arithmetic engines sucking heat through her souls. But when she broke away, I shook my head, disappointed in myself. I neglected one possibility. Lady Arryk went outside because we had a problem with the ninth stone. When it was missing, I assumed that it had broken away at the same time, going off on its own trajectory.
But Lady Arryk was a survivor, Pinky said.
I nodded. Yes, she was. Probably Rose said.
So she took the stone, yes and yes?
It's the only way she could have survived long enough to escape Bright Sun. In her stronghold, the first time she showed us a stone, she said it wasn't enough to protect a ship, but she did say it would have sufficed to protect a single spacesuit. That's what she must have done. She didn't choose to break away from us, but in the moment when she knew it was inevitable, she must have managed to take the stone along with her. The conformal skein wrapped her like a second skin. The forces on her would still have been hellish, but because she was moving quickly, they'd have fallen away quickly as well.
But without any protection from the cryo-arithmetics, Pinky said.
There's that. But Lady Arryk said the Gideon stones have some thermal shielding properties as well. Combined with the emergency life support measures of her suit, the acceleration buffering she was already experiencing, I believe it's possible that she lived. Is. Alive.
But she's been silent until now,
Barras said. There are two possibilities, I think. Either she was aware of wolf activity and was withholding her transmissions, or the suit has only just brought her back to consciousness. I don't think it's very likely to be the former. Pinky looked at me with all the intensity of which he was capable.
This had better not be a mirage, Warglass.
I sincerely hope it isn't.
I need more than hope.
So do we all. Which is why I advocate an immediate departure. There's no telling how close that suit is to the end of its life support capability, or what condition Lady Arryk is in. The pulses are very faint, even allowing for the suit's distance. Pinky looked uneasily at Barras.
When you say immediately?
Within the next 26 hours, I answered. Sooner still, if I had my way. And I'm afraid it can't be a question of going out there, finding Lady Arryk, and returning to Ararat. Every time we move through this system, or come and go from this planet, we endanger ourselves and everyone here. When we leave for good, and anyone not aboard Scythe will have to learn to live here, with all that that entails.
Some hard choices just got harder, Pinky said.
Barras shook his head slowly.
I'm not sure that they did. I think this may even help us.
We could spend weeks talking about living here or leaving here and never get any closer to a decision. But if there's a life to be saved, and if that life also happens to be Lady Arryk's...
He made to stand up from the loose circle.
We'll put it to the others. But as far as I'm concerned, my mind's settled. You've given us a world to live on, somewhere a lot better than the last place. And I trust that these people will help us make it work.
The mariners had been content to listen until then, passing no judgment or observation. One said,
"The road to the sea is not an easy one, but many have walked it."
"We will be there to guide and to welcome," said another.
Probably Rose stood up next to Barras.
"They should vote, as Barras says, but the less time it takes you to leave, the better."
"There's a place on Scythe for anyone who wishes to come with us," I said, noting that probably Rose had already cast her lot with the remainers. "If we leave in 26 hours, or 13, that promise still holds."
"We know," Barras said, "and I'll make sure the message gets around. But I know the pigs, and I've already seen the way the mood is turning. They're ready to join the mariners."
"Not all," I said.
"The doubters'll see the light. Lady Arryk's name always carried a lot of weight in the swinehouse. They'll want to do what they can for her now, and delaying even a few hours won't help her at all."
"No one should be cajoled," I said.
Barras made a dismissive gesture in my direction.
"Go and do what you need to do to get that ship ready to leave, Warglass. And, Pinky, you know you'll be keeping her company. So do what you need to do as well."
Pinky scratched a heel against the green slicked rock beneath him.
"Just when this place was starting to grow on me."
In the end, 13 hours was all it took. Barras had been right about his promise of unanimity, however it was achieved. I was already on the back of the ship, looking down as Pinky hugged probably Rose, whispering something to the human woman before turning away and scrambling up laddered recesses onto the hull. Then it was a brief wave to Barras and the others, doubtful promises made and fond hopes offered. It was all happening too quickly, and I felt pangs of guilty abandonment. I believed in the good intentions of the mariners, that they would do all in their power to shepherd their new flock into the sea. But we were still leaving these people to a desperately uncertain fate. The only shred of forgiveness I could offer myself was that our own future was no more settled, perhaps less so. But whatever hopes we had, they would be improved by the presence of Lady Arryk. Therefore, we were compelled to leave, and every hour that we delayed was another hour in which she was at the failing mercy of her suit. "I'm sorry that it's ended up this way," I said to probably Rose. "Sorry that we've been forced to make this choice. But I'm not sorry to put this burden on you. I think you can take it. I think you're at least as strong as any of us." She glanced away, as if my praise stung her.
"Find Lady Arryk for us, and verily?"
I nodded heartfelt affirmation.
"We will.
And when we've gone out there and found whatever it is we need in Charybdis, we'll come back to Ararat."
"It won't be the same, yes and yes."
"No. I doubt that it will be. But I do know that it will be better for your being here. I'm sorry about Snowdrop, Amori, and the others. They were your friends, just as surely as they were Pinky's. But we'll make sure that their sacrifices weren't in vain."
"You never did ask me about my name, Warglass."
"Were you expecting me to?"
"Most do, yes, and verily. They think it's..."
She made the self-cuffing gesture, gently smacking the side of her forehead as if a gear had stuck.
"They think it's strange."
"It is. But strangeness isn't bad. Look at me."
"Yes," she admitted. "Look at you, Warglass."
Then, as if continuing the same thread, "There was a pig in the swinehouse. After what I'd done to her, she couldn't live. But she never blamed me for any of that. She forgave me, yes.
Yes and yes."
Gently, I asked,
"Was her name Rose?"
"Probably. They weren't sure. No one was."
She didn't have a tongue by then. Something in me tightened like an overwound mainspring. Did they make you take her tongue? And verily, I'm sorry for what they made you do. Later, when I had my chance to escape, she was the one who helped me get out. She knew she wouldn't leave herself, and she knew what the Swine Queen would do to her. Something terrible played behind her one remaining eye. Yes, yes and yes. So I said I'd take her name. I couldn't take her, but I could take her name. I said I'd always be, probably Rose, and I'd never be anything else. She looked out at the sea. Do you think I'll remember when it changes me? I think you'll remember everything that matters, I said. And Rose, probably Rose, thank you for everything. You should go now, Warglass, she said with a certain sternness. Go and save Lady Arryk. Yes, yes, I answered. And verily. Farewells completed, Pinky and I went inside and sealed up. We were silent together for a few minutes, preoccupied with our thoughts. There was so much to say that neither of us knew where to start. The act of departure was just too big, too monumental, to begin to talk about. I felt simultaneously as if we were fleeing one responsibility and throwing ourselves headlong into another, that we were turning our backs on friends because of the pull of another friend who needed us. It was good to have the technical business of the ship to focus on. Rather than taking off directly, I opened ingestion ports in Scythe's flanks, sucking in seawater, running it through hyperdiamond compressors and using it for thrust. Gradually, the seaweed loosened its hold on the hull and we drifted away from first camp, moving gently into deepening waters. I waited until we were a kilometer clear of land and the gathered onlookers, before lifting from the sea, still using the jet compressors. We executed a farewell circuit of first camp, then arrowed for space, making a quiet departure from the atmosphere, ruffling it to the minimum extent, dark drives and cryo-arithmetic engines working to cloak us from the notice of wolves. They'll be all right, Pinky said at last. They will, I agreed. But almost immediately Pinky dashed my already fragile confidence by adding, I hope. Lady Arryk had travelled 500 million kilometres since breaking away inside Bright Sun. Her course had been nearly straight, with just the smallest deflection due to the gravitational influence of the star, its nearest worlds, and the distant influence of its twin. We would have caught up with her whichever way she was moving, but it happened that her vector was aligned with the same quadrant of sky in which Charybdis lay. That was luck, and nothing else. But it saved us time and minimized the velocity changes that we needed to make while still within the stellar environment of Bright Sun. Scythe could have passed Lady Arryk's position within a couple of days of leaving Ararat, but the need to match her speed made the rendezvous more time-consuming, and it took more than a week to close in on her pulse. In the last 2 days of our approach, the pulses became weaker still, with the gaps between them elongating. By then, though, it hardly mattered whether the pulses kept coming. Pinky and I had narrowed down her expected position to a moving volume about 10 kilometers across. When we got there, we could use passive sensor methods to locate the suit. Pinky was anxious about those diminishing pulses. I felt for him, but there was nothing I could offer by way of reassurance. He had been through the loss of her once, then offered the promise of her still being alive, and now his fortitude was being tested a second time by the thought of finding her dead and drifting. The universe won't do this to us, I whispered to myself. It's indifferent, but it isn't actually cruel. Perhaps I believed myself for a moment or two. 52 hours out from contact, Lady Arryk was completely silent. Most of the next 2 days was spent with Pinky and I saying as little to each other as we could get away with. It was not that we had fallen out, but that our nerves were equally strained and our mutual capacity for patience and tolerance nearly exhausted. Scythe's first glimpse of Lady Arryk was a moving speck of warmth, about the size of a person. Warm enough to be alive,
I dared not speculate. She had been inside a star not too long ago. Perhaps all we were seeing was the slow fading out of a cinder, a dying spark falling into interstellar darkness. I brought Scythe nearer, until we were about a kilometer out. At that range, even though we were far beyond Ararat's orbit, there was still enough light from bright sun to illuminate the suit. Pinky and I watched the slow spinning form from within the control room, neither of us offering comment. In my mind's eye, I had imagined her speeding into space with her visor to the stars, but the reality was less dignified. At some point in her crossing, she had begun to tumble end over end. Other than that continuing movement, there was no trace of mobility. Scythe could read some system's activity from the suit, picking up thermal and electromagnetic signals, but to my own neural senses, it was mute. Diagnostic queries went unanswered, nor could I detect any aspect of Lady Alec's mind within it. But there was one thing to which we could pin our hopes, however feebly. Lady Alec was bent nearly double, pressing something to her belly. She must still have the ninth stone, even though we could see no sign of its skein. Without a word of preamble, Pinky said, "I'll go." I offered no debate, merely a nod of understanding. He knew how to use the suits and airlock systems well enough by now. A couple of minutes later, I watched him depart, using cold gas thrusters to speed over to the tumbling form. His suit was smaller than hers, of course, and to begin with, her momentum overwhelmed his own. But by gradual taps of gas, Pinky was able to stabilize the two of them and then haul the unresponsive suit back into the ship. I was rather glad when he did, for this was the last bit of business we needed to attend to before committing for deep space. I felt nervous and exposed until the locks sealed over. Trusting Scythe to manage itself for a while, and preferring not to leave anything to the robots, I went down to the dock and met Pinky as he emerged back into pressure. He hauled the other suit behind him, an awkward job, even in temporary weightlessness. "It's in a bad way," I said, appraising the suit's visible damage. The outer layer of it was mostly black and blistered, with a bronzy sheen over the least damaged parts. The visor was fogged, and no status indications shone from any parts of the suit. I breathed slowly, reminding myself that Lady Alec would have had no cause to adjust her system preferences to make those indications visible.
"I can see it's in a bad way."
He was out of his own suit by then, barely giving it a glance as it shuffled itself back into storage.
"Tell me something I can't see with my own two eyes, Warglass."
The suit was not disclosing its contents automatically. Gently, I dug around Lady Alec's hands and extracted the Gideon stone from her grasp. I felt it fit in my own bare fingers, reacquainting myself with the familiar roughness of its texture, its density and coldness. The scarlet light still throbbed within, but weakly. "It's dormant," I said quietly, "but I don't think it's dead. I think it likely that the stone gave up a lot of itself getting her clear of bright sun, and now it's in a recuperative phase."
"Would she have needed it once she was clear?"
I had no good answer to that question. She was travelling quite quickly, and with only the armour of her suit for protection. The skein would have been useful if she ran into any micrometeorites, but she can't have run into anything big.
"Or she wouldn't be here."
"The skein would have barriered her, but there wouldn't have been much it could do about a sudden deceleration, beyond anything the suit could have protected her from." I sketched my hand over the charred form. "This damage looks bad, and it's clear the suit lacked the energy or material reserves to heal itself externally. But that doesn't tell us anything about what's inside." He looked at me, or rather at the space just above my eyes, behind my forehead.
"You're still not getting anything?"
"Not yet."
"The suit should open on its own, shouldn't it?"
"Not if it doesn't know where it is, or what's happened. If its sensors are really badly damaged, it won't even know it isn't in vacuum." I frowned, trying various command and control protocols, attempting to override the suit's perfectly reasonable instincts towards host preservation, but my signals were bouncing off it, charms that had lost their potency.
I sighed.
What?
We'll have to cut our way in. There's nothing else for it. The suit's stone dead, except for some very low-level functionality which could mean anything and nothing.
You're a bundle of reassurance, Warglass.
He needed his mind taken off the matter at hand. Go to the weapons archive, Pinky. Bring blades and short-range cutters. Even a Boser pistol.
Is that an order?
A friend, asking nicely.
He pondered that for a second. All right.
He was gone,
and that was all that I wanted. Of course, I needed no extra equipment to break into her suit. Everything I could have wanted was available in the suits already. I summoned a suit, stepped in, and cycled through the minimum functionality tests. I detached the self-merging helmet and set it aside. It was only the suit's tools and weapons that were of use to me now, and I thought it would be easier on Pinky to see my face if he came back before I was done. I straddled Lady Arryk, then commanded my right glove to form a precision-cutting function. My forefinger elongated, the tip flattening and sharpening to a scalpel-like shape. I touched the blade to the crown of Lady Arryk's helmet and dug in slowly and carefully, alert to the material's diagnostic telemetry issuing from the cutter. My glove vibrated faintly as the blade engaged its microscopic cutting mechanisms. The blade was both tool and laboratory, and would deactivate itself the instant it strayed into anything that resembled living tissue. But I dared not place undue confidence in its infallibility. The blade cut through the suit's layers with only moderate resistance. It helped that these were compatible technologies, products of a common engineering philosophy. According to the diagnostics, the charring was confined to the last few millimeters of the suit's integument, with progressively less damage the further in I went. That was encouraging. The innermost parts, just before I burst through into the body cavity, were showing normal consistency. Lady Arryk's suit was not fighting back against this intrusion, though. I worked my way down. I cut a narrow groove down the visor, through the neck joint, into the upper chest. The damaged layers of the suit gave off a powerful, acidic stench, and I had to keep blinking away tears of irritation. All along I was waiting for something horrible to hit me from further in, the choke of cooked or corrupted flesh. I worked my way down Lady Arryk's belly, stopping just above her hip. The groove was still only a black line, the edges nearly touching. I deactivated the tool, returning my glove to its default condition. Glancing back at the entrance to the suiting area, half expecting to see Pinky returning, I pressed my fingers into the groove, just above her ribcage. It took effort to force my way in, more than my muscles alone could have managed. But with a gasp and a creak, the suit relented. It split open along a widening fissure, and as the smell hit me from within, I nearly fell back in distaste. It was a very bad smell, and I batted it away from my nostrils, gagging on a cough. But it was not the smell of a body that had been cooked or allowed to rot. It was just a human consequence of being bottled inside a suit for too many days, with the usual filtering and waste recycling measures running at a reduced efficiency. Just the natural result of being alive. I pulled Lady Arryk out of the suit. She came out in a slithering, greasy mass, like something that had just been born. She was unconscious and unresponsive, but she was not dead. Oh, you!
I turned to Pinky. Not a word, Scorp. Not a fucking word.
You tricked me, you bastard.
And now you don't have to be the one who opened this suit. I brushed Lady Arryk's hair away from her forehead. I didn't know what we'd find. If it was as bad as I feared, I didn't want you to be the one who saw her. You've seen enough. You've been through enough. Some of his anger bled away, but his chest was still heaving up and down, his hands still tight on the excellent assortment of cutting implements he had come back with.
I could use these on you.
You could try. I paused and pressed my forehead against Lady Arryk's, hugging her into me as if she were the last fixed thing in the universe, the last and final point of reference. There's something Neural housekeeping, just enough to read. She's in there.
My eyes were closed, her skin sticking to mine. It was the cushioning gel that had been inside the suit when she went outside Scythe, broken down into a viscous, lumpy grease.
She's there.
I want her back,
Pinky said, and he let go of the blades, allowing them to float from his fingers. 3 days later, Lady Arik came back to us. Pinky and I were waiting, keeping a vigil at her bedside. We had been observing her for hours, saying very little. Scythe had been accelerating steadily since retrieving the suit, and I anticipated no further difficulties before we reached Charybdis.
Pinky, she said, her eyes settling on him. Dear Pinky, you found me in the end.
Either that, or some undocumented part of my brain is giving me a very agreeable fantasy.
Pinky pinched himself.
I think I'm real.
I think you are real as well. How long has it been?
You were out there for 26 days,
he told her,
falling through the system at a few hundred kilometers per second. We picked you up 3 days ago, but it's taken until now for you to come around. You were a long way under.
Did I still have the stone?
Yes, and we'll add it back to the collection.
That is good. Our plight will be marginal with 9. With 8, we would have very little hope at all.
I see you haven't lost your talent for morale building, your ladyship.
Nor you your talent for reminding me of my limits, Pinky.
She smiled.
For which I remain grateful.
She turned to me next.
I felt you, Hourglass. You were trying to pull me back into the light.
Thank you.
You gave me something to struggle towards.
You were a long way in, I said.
You must have seen the condition of my suit. Almost the last thing it was capable of doing was keeping me alive, and even that became a struggle in the end.
I said, your pulses were fading out.
My decision to conserve energy. I took a gamble, which was to count on you detecting and acting on my pulses when they were at their strongest. I presumed that you had launched the ship and were closing in on my position. If I was right in that presumption, it was safe to reduce the pulse intensity, because you should be close enough to detect and localize them.
It was quite a gamble.
I would think it the sort of thing you admired, Hourglass. All or nothing. Every iron in the fire.
But she tilted her head finally.
It is you, Hourglass. But something is different.
Then some redawning clarity of mind had her looking beyond our faces.
Clavain, if you are here, I would have expected him to be here as well.
Something happened on Ararat, Pinky said.
Did you obtain the intelligence?
Yes, I said, bristling a little at her directness.
The information is secure.
We know our destination.
It's locked in as we speak. As soon as the ship declares you strong enough, we'll go into reefer sleep.
Clavain swam.
I nodded.
Clavain swam.
And he met his brother?
I did, Lady Arik.
She frowned at me, puzzlement giving way to doubt, and then a brittle comprehension.
Oh, Hourglass.
Oh, indeed.
What have you become?
Something that didn't exist before.
Something new in the universe.
What strange times we find ourselves in, said the woman spat out by a star,
Pinky said.